Okay, so I'm not going to be talking about jets, and I won't even mention magnetic field or GR once in my talk. Okay, people are still here, so I'll continue. But I am going to be talking about outflows, and there are other signatures of outflows other than jets. Here are my collaborators. Yair Krongold was the postdoc working with us who did most of the work on Chandra observations that I'm going to be talking about. So the observational signatures I'm going to be talking to you about on outflows were taken from Quisto theorist. This is Hubble. This is Chandra. And this is? Who said that? Oh no, you're a quasi theorist. Okay, as you said. Okay, so that's few. So it's Chandra in X-ray and Hubble and Fuse in ultraviolet, which is what I'll talk about. All right. So what are the UV and FUV signatures of outflow? When you look at AGN, mostly the spectra are dominated by emission lines. And here just some examples. Here is a carbon 4 emission lines, and on top of that, you see that there are absorption lines. There is one particular system here. Carbon 4 is a doublet, so you see doublet absorption pretty strong here. And since these absorption lines are blue shifted with respect to the emission lines, we infer that as outflows coming, you know, towards us. The nuclear region. You again see also nitrogen 5 absorption line from the same system at exactly the same outflow velocity, as well as we see this is Lyman Alpha here. We have H1 absorption in this same system. So such absorption lines intrinsic to the AGN or quasars were known since basically quasars were discovered some 40 odd years ago. So why are we still talking about them? Just like jets were discovered long ago and we are still talking about them, we are now still wondering about these outflows coming from AGNs. And partly is because AGN feedback has become a key word in practically every problem observational cosmologists have discovered, right? So if you have cooling flow problem, if you have truncated disk, and if you have a variety of other things, the anything that you want to solve your problem was has to do with AGN outflows, and so this has become a very interesting field suddenly. But many of us thought outflows were interesting just because they are actually allowing us to probe circumnuclear regions of quasars, so even before it became fashionable. And part of the reason it has become now interesting in its own right is because it's newly now recognized as semi-universal. Okay, so in the 50% of seafloors, we see these kinds of signatures of outflow. So that means it's telling us that, you know, either its covering fraction, as we see it, is 50%, or there are 50% of objects in which conditions arise in which we can see such outflows. We are also now figured out that this is a dynamically important phase in the nucleus of the quasar, because the outflow, mass outflow rate, is quite comparable to the accretion rate in the center. So if you want to understand the entire accretion process, we do need to understand also the process of outflow, which is related to that. And also the energy carried out in this outflow is also becomes comparable, a good fraction of that we see in the luminosity of the luminosity of AGN. Pardon me? It's mostly comparable, I would say. There is one case in which, within uncertainties, one can say it's greater, but not really. I'll also show you that we can now put together all atomic absorption features in the AGN to a very good extent, and that's very interesting. And this is sort of the convergence of warm observer scenarios that Julian was sort of mentioning yesterday. And all these things, the advances we have done in understanding these outflows, really allow us to measure the physical quantities in the nuclear regions of AGNs, and leading to a very qualitative advance in our understanding of AGNs. Okay? So in addition to UV signatures that I talked about, there are also X-ray signatures in the spectra of AGNs. So if you have a power loss spectrum, in the pre-Chandra era, what we saw with Rosette and ASCA are these absorption edges. Okay? So these edges are basically bound-free transitions from highly ionized oxygen. This is oxygen 7K edge and oxygen 8K edge. Okay, so this is basically helium-like and hydrogen-like ions. Mostly in the UV band, we actually see the transitions of lithium-like ions. In X-rays, mostly we see hydrogen and helium-like ions. All right. So these are the edges that we see. Earlier, X-ray resolution was not good enough to actually measure the outflow velocity, but the models of combining the physical properties in both UV and X-ray band basically allowed us to predict that these should be also show the signatures of outflow, and indeed that's what we now see with Chandra. So these ionized absorption edges that we see, this system is basically what's termed warm absorbers, if you have heard this word before, and it's just called warm because it's very highly ionized gas of U of about 1. So ask me what is U. No, I don't have sigma or Q, but I do have U. Okay, so the U here is ionization parameter, which is the ratio of essentially the photon density to electron density. Okay, so this is basically telling you there's highly ionized gas here, and that's what it was termed warm. Warm against hot. Hot would be totally, completely ionized and so transparent to X-rays. So warm really basically means a partially ionized gas. All right. So this is photoionized because of the continuum, which is coming from the nucleus. And as I said, these blue shifts really are telling us about outflows. And the Chandra and XMM observations really do show that these, even the X-ray lines are outflowing, are blue shifted with the velocities of the order of 1,000 kilometers per second as we had expected. So all in all, warm observers have potential to deliver much physics of the nucleus of the AGN. So what we find out by doing studying these absorption features is really we can really fully characterize the plasma, which is actually making these absorption features. Okay? For example, if you study variability, then from the recombination or ionization time lag to the continuum changes, we can actually find out what is the density of the gas. Okay? Then we can actually find out the radial distance, knowing the density, ionization parameter, and the luminosity of the AGN. We can also determine its size because we measure the column density through the absorption lines, and then we have the measure of the density as shown here that allows us to tell us what is the size of the absorber. We can calculate the temperature, which is generally self-consistently calculated, putting in all heating and cooling processes, and it does response to the continuum changes. And of course, we can also calculate the pressure, knowing the density and temperature and mass outflow rate, etc. So basically, with all the information that we have and few measured parameters of all the ions that we see, we can really fully define the physical characteristic of the plasma that we observe, which is somewhat different than compared to the emission line studies that people have been doing. So this is really the power of studying absorption lines around AGNs. So this is sort of the punchline that I've given you, but I will now discuss the more advances that are coming with the Chandra observations. So what are the typical parameters that we do actually derive? Very good variability observations, unfortunately, could be done only for a few AGNs. Here are a few named here. For which we can actually determine density, and so all other parameters get determined accordingly. The temperatures are of the order of 10,000 K, and the distances of are order of a fraction of a parsec to a few parsecs. And but the problem with these early observations that there were large, not only statistical uncertainties, there were also some systematic errors from the simple physics that that was used, which of course may not be the case. For example, I had shown you earlier that all that we could see here in the earlier X-ray spectra were the strong edges, which we could see from very high column density gases. But the situation is more complex from that, because such a gas also has line absorption features, and which get confused in the low resolution spectra that I showed before. So because of these uncertainties, which now we have a potential to actually resolve these narrow absorption lines with the higher resolution grating observations that are now actually available with Chandra, that we can make more progress than what we had done before. So here is just the best studied case of an AGN, which is the Chandra 900 kilosecond observation of NGC 3783, and it's really a very, very beautiful spectrum. And immediately what you notice is, just as you expected, line absorption in the UV and in the X-ray spectra from a variety of elements going all across the soft X-ray and hard X-ray band. Okay, so here the numbers on x-axis here, 1.523, are actually wavelengths. Okay, so the X-ray astronomy has graduated from talking about EVs and KEVs to wavelengths, and that is thanks to gratings on Chandra. So we are actually talking about lines at few angstroms, and you can see there variety of elements from calcium, argon, sulfur, magnesium, iron, and a huge number of lines we can actually very, very clearly see. Okay, and more here, so oxygen here, again, nitrogen, so huge number of lines that are seen. So even though we expected to see lines when we had high resolution grating observations, the initial reactions to the from the community when such a rich spectra were observed were that of confusion, that, oh my god, there are so many of these lines, how were we ever going to understand them in some sort of a simple picture, because the spectra looked so very complex. And so the natural initial results were that, okay, So the spectra are so complex that they must have some complicated solutions, because otherwise how are we ever going to understand all these lines? I mean, there are some 100 lines in the NGC 3783 spectrum, so how are we ever going to understand such rich spectrum? So there were lots of early models trying to explain such rich spectra in terms of very complicated solution, which included many phases of warm observer at different different distances, possibility of dust, possibility of very broad emission lines, possibility of excess high abundance, and maybe a continuous range of the ionization parameter, and so on and so forth. So the problem with all these models is that, yes, there were early attempts, but nonetheless, because of the complexity, we couldn't really probe these many components. Because of the many components, there wasn't easy way to actually understand what's going on in the nuclear regions of AGN. So we tried to take another look at it by doing detailed modeling of the NGC 3783 spectrum, which is, in fact, one of the best spectrum observed by Chandra, and for which we developed a photoionization model code by using hundreds, I mean, I think there are over 400 lines in the code. And so we started an approach to actually first build the total model and then try to fit it to the data, rather than going line by line and then see what are the best fit parameters to these few lines of these few elements. So this is sort of a global approach to understand this rich spectra that were observed with Chandra. Okay, so there are very, very few free parameters in the model, namely five. And so this really was sort of ambitious thing to do, but in the end, I think it was very worth the effort, which as I said, EIA did very well. So what I'm going to show you now is really the fit to the Chandra spectrum of NGC 3783. So in black is the data, and in red are the model spectra. And as you can see, as we go through the entire wavelength range, it is very, very well fit. And now this is in the 10 angstrom region. There is nickel, magnesium, and so on. And then you have, again, now we are moving to the 13 angstrom region. Again, you can see the excellent fit of data to the model and a little bit higher wavelength. Lots of oxygen features here. And here is what is called the IR M-shell UTA. UTA stands for the unresolved array, which is basically lots of iron transitions bunched together, which are transitioned from the M shell of the of iron. Okay, so that's N equal to three. So this actually I'll show you later becomes a very powerful diagnostic feature to understand these spectra. Okay, so just moving on to higher wavelength, again you can see basically the idea here is to show the excellent fit of the absorption lines to the model. All right, so what it has basically allowed us to model this very rich over 100 line spectrum with just two phase absorbers, one which is relatively cooler of the order of 10,000 K, and one is more hotter of the order of million degrees. And these two observers also appear to be in pressure balance with each other. So it's a very elegant solution to this very rich, complex spectrum. So if you plot the position of these two phases that we found, the one of high ionization parameter component and one the low ionization parameter component on the classic temperature pressure equilibrium curve like Krolik, Mackey and Tarter done for interstellar medium of the galaxy, you can really see that they are actually sitting at the same pressure point. And so that's very interesting. And this solution is also similar to independently also calculated by Netzer and collaborators, which also gives us confidence in our solution. Netzer et al. Also found a possible third component in a very hot phase, which is also in pressure balance in this kind of same region of the pressure. So, which is also consistent with our data, but since the signature of that even hotter component is so low that we didn't make more of it. Okay.
That means that your component there sits in
the higher band.
In a stable
region? Oh, this middle one, actually there is a quasi-stable region which is created there, and this exact nature of the quasi-stellar part of this equilibrium S curve depends upon the input spectral energy distribution, and that's easy to get reproduced. And pardon me? Assume spectrum is the observed spectrum of 3783, which of course we do not know the EUV part of. So we try to change. Right, so this is the observed Chandra spectrum was put in.
To get to 78 phase, you've got to say something way beyond the Chandra band.
No, yes, but we don't have anything beyond the Chandra band.
You said something about it, if you get a constant
that would be that high. Okay, I'll talk to you about that later. I'll look into that. But but what we have is really the observed one. Okay. You don't take out that 1 minute. So as I told you that one of the very interesting feature here is the iron unresolved transitional array around 18 angstrom, and it is very, very sensitive to the ionization parameter as shown here. As you go from minus 0.5 to 1, minus 1, it really shifts in its position. And because it's such a broad feature, even your signal to noise is a little bit low in this region of around 16 angstrom, it is very easy to see the changes in the shape of the UTA as the flux changes. And in 3783, we also found that as the flux goes from high, which is in red here, to black, which is low here. This is the model showing how the UTA would change. And this is sort of exactly how it was observed. And because the solution is so simple, just the two-phase observer, we can actually make use of the variability analysis. And so again, here, the same thing showed in a different way, that this is the high to low phase data model, as you would expect in 3783, and this is how it is observed. And because of these changes, observed changes in the opacity variation of the UTA, we can actually constrain its density, and so the distance to less than 6 parsec. Okay, so basically, this is very consistent with a very heavily clumped gas, very close to the nucleus of the AGN, and these kinds of observations really rule out models which really call for a very continuous range of ionization parameters in these absorbing outflow. So I think the point about all these high resolution observations is now we really do some kind of a precision modeling of the physical conditions in the in absorbing outflows, and it and if you model them and you if you find how they change with time, we can also constrain their geometry, which I will not talk more about. But the point here is that eventually you want to find out where these are coming from, whether these are disk lines, these are the disk outflows, or they're coming from somewhere else, like torus or something like that. And I believe Daniel Proga would make the case for disk outflows tomorrow. And I cannot talk about something more interesting, which I'll stop here.
So I have a comment and a question. The comment is, I think it might be misleading to say that the so-called complexity in the Wollman's orbit was just a collective panic we all had because of the complexity of the spectra. There are actually well-defined characteristics in many of these spectra which lead us, for example, to conclude that there are actually two components. For example, there's very different ionization states, so it's very hard to make one zone. And there's also kinematic distinctions. You clearly see kinematically distinct absorbers. There are actually fairly clear signatures of embedded dust in some of the Wollman's orbit. So there are fairly well established, there are fairly well defined features of the spectrum which lead you to some of these complex models. The question is, of course, these are all radio quiet objects. So trying to make a connection to some of yesterday's talks, what is the current status of warm absorbers in radio loud objects?
There isn't any spectrum of the quality of 3783 of any of the radio loud objects. And so it is obviously much more difficult to make similar kind of comparison. But the complexity issue, I mean, yes, your point is well taken, that yes, there are some objects, I'm not saying that in which there isn't higher complexity is not observed. I mean, I'm aware of the dust features and all that. But I think there are many papers in which the complexity was put in because the simple solution could not be found. And I think, I mean, I don't want to name names right now, but that's really the kind of thing I'm trying to bring out here, that there is it's far more elegant solution by trying to do this global kind of a fit. If you go from ion to ion and line to line, it becomes very, very messy very quickly, and it's very hard to find out where you went wrong.
Since the microphone is conveniently here in the back row, just jump in first. A couple of comments and then a question.
Yes.
The first comment is that I see that you are placing the warm absorber now somewhere out at a few parsecs, so rather far outside the broadline region of your initial thoughts.
Yes. Okay. So the point is, I mean, I'm sure I would let Daniel talk about this wins, but the earlier constraint was that it was outside of the broadline region. okay, and it is still outside of the broadline region, and it does not contradict that, because the emission, I mean, if you look at the UV lines, if they, we see them covering the emission line because of their depth, they've got to be outside, and 6 parsec is still outside. And again, 6 parsec is an upper limit, so it could be few parsec.
The second comment is that looking at your temperature equilibrium diagram, it was clear that you are assuming a rather hard X-ray continuum extension, because otherwise you wouldn't get a Compton temperature of close to 10 to the 8th Kelvin. Now, if you used
what is actually
a somewhat more conventional continuum spectrum, that would actually make the mid-temperature range, the few hundred thousand, a few million degree range, more nearly vertical in that picture, which would also reduce it to only marginal thermal instability, making that 10 to the 6th K point more physically plausible. So in fact, I believe a more realistic continuum would alleviate that problem, and it would also put you in the range of where most of the other workers in the field identify this system. And that leads my question, which is, there was recently published a very detailed analysis of the same data by Shalush and Netzer, in which they came to a qualitatively similar conclusion. I was wondering if you wanted to comment on the contrast.
Right. No, I mean, I am very, very much aware of Netzer and collaborators' work, and it's qualitatively very, very similar. So we really don't have any disagreements, except that additional component of which is very high temperature, which is a very high ionization parameter. And that there are only a few lines, the signature of that very hard component is only few lines. I mean, I remember two, but I think they are of the order of one handful at most. And that's why we hadn't talked about it in the paper, but they are there. We comment on that, that it is a possible third component.
So there really are more components. You also have several other lower ionization
components.
No. All the same pressure.
Same pressure, yeah.
That's
absolutely.
Basically the content of the continuum distribution at fixed capital E.
Right.
This constant pressure, I have two questions, but first one is, that was a requirement while you were doing the...
No.
It just came out of...
It came out of it, yeah.
And is that true also for Netzer's...
Yes. Yes, it is.
And
the question was whether it was put in or it just came out of it.
I should say, in the case of the Shalush and Netzer work, they were forced to that conclusion quite contrary to the earlier work by that group.
Yes.
Which
yeah.
had rather vehemently opposed pressure balance.
Right, exactly. I mean, earlier Kospietal results were very different from what I presented, and the new work from Netzer et al. Is exactly consistent with what we found.
So knowing the pressure and the fact that we are studying certain lines for which we have blue shift, is this, can we tell if those flows are supersonic or subsonic? How significant that pressure balance is as far as dynamics is concerned? That's.
I don't think anything supersonic here, but I haven't calculated the speed of sound in this medium.
Okay.
It's outflow speed. I mean, the micro speed of sound would depend on what is the micro turbulent velocity and things like that. But yeah, I don't know offhand the answer. Do you know, Julian? I don't know.
Well, fundamentally, we're seeing outflow speeds of 300 to 1,000 kilometers per second. At a temperature of a million degrees, that's a sound speed of around 100, 150 kilometers per second, so it is somewhat supersonic.
I wanted to offer a quick answer to Chris Reynolds' question about absorbers in radio loud AGNs.
Yeah, go ahead.
So let me see if I understand the question. Is the question, do we know of any warm absorbers in radio loud AGNs?
Oh, that we knew. 3C351, my first one, but not of this spectral quality.
Well, in general, is there evidence for warm absorbers in radio loud?
Yes, there is.
Hang on, wait for the microphone.
the old law from ASCO was that the radio loud objects showed much less in the way of warm absorption than the radio quiet objects. And I was just basically asking for an update on that. I mean, the old story was that radio loud objects don't show warm absorption.
Okay, old story is that broad absorption line quasar, which is sort of the extremum in this continuum range of the outflow velocity, broad absorption line quasars where you see outflows with the speeds of about fraction of C, and those were usually considered to be the radio quiet ones. And when we see these kinds of associated observers with sort of intermediate kind of outflow velocities, they were typically thought to be radio loud ones. But in CFIRDS, all that is sort of getting mixed up because NGC 5548, which is technically radio quiet, has big radio lobes. And so we basically see them in 50% of CFIRDS, and which are all sort of radio quiet.
I just wanted to say that there's a very strong selection effect, observational selection effect here, that you have very bright nearby radio quiet objects and the radio loud objects are much further away and fainter. So
yes, so we don't have very high resolution spectra of any of them.
Good resolution spectra of radio loud objects.
Correct.
So trying to answer that question. As far as I know from X-ray observations, there is one radio loud AGN whose ASCA spectrum showed a hint of a warm absorber, and that is 3C392.3.
Some of it's signal to noise, but it wasn't all signal to noise. I mean, there were appreciably lower, for example, oxygen edge opacities in the radio loud as compared to the radio quiet.
That is not that obvious, again, because we have small number statistics. But at least if you just consider column densities, for example, 3C351 still has 10 to the power 22, and which is similar to what we see here in CFIRDS. So exactly how the properties change with going from CFIRDS to quasar and going from radio loud to quiet is not yet settled, I would say.
I'm actually going to stop the discussion there. I suggest we have a warm absorber table at lunch and continue over lunch. Remember, there's no session this afternoon. Go to the beach.
Very nice.
Thank you.